Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director here at the Institute. And it's my great pleasure to be hosting today's conversation with Graham Freudenberg and Michael Cooney on speeches in foreign policy. Those of you who know me know that I'm a speech fan. I believe there's no better way to make your arguments and tell your story than with a speech. Often, it seems these days that no meeting is complete without a PowerPoint slide. But in my opinion, a PowerPoint slide never changed anyone's life, except maybe for the worse. Speeches change people's lives. What we want to talk about today is the role of speeches in foreign policy. And the hook is that this year, a couple of months ago, in fact, is the 50th anniversary of Arthur Calwell's masterful parliamentary statement of opposition to the Vietnam War in 1965. It was delivered in response to Prime Minister Menzies' announcement 4 days earlier that Australia would send an infantry battalion to assist the government of South Vietnam. And Calwell laid out his party's principled position in plain English, argument upon argument. He refused to shrink the alliance to the dimensions of a single conflict. And most people would say that his speech was vindicated by history. He closed the speech in this way, speaking to the MPs on his own side. "We are doing our duty as we see it. When the drums beat and the trumpets sound, the voice of reason and right can be heard in the land only with difficulty. But if we are to have the courage of our convictions, then we must do our best to make that voice heard. I offer you the probability that you will be traduced, that your motives will be represented, that your patriotism will be impugned, that your courage will be called into question. But I also offer you the sure and certain knowledge that we will be vindicated, that generations to come will record with gratitude that when a reckless government willfully endangered the security of this nation, the voice of the Australian Labor Party was heard strong and clear on the side of sanity and in the cause of humanity and in the interests of Australia's security." Menzies responded in the House later that afternoon, and his response concluded, "If I may end on a horribly political note, it is a good thing occasionally to be in a big majority." Because, of course, Calwell's speech was being given into the headwinds of popular and elite opinion. So, as one of the great speeches in the history of Australian foreign policy, one that's beautifully written, one that we look back on now, I thought this was an ideal time to think about the role of speeches in foreign policy. And we are very honoured indeed to have with us Graham Freudenberg AM, who was the principal author of Arthur Calwell's speech half a century ago. Graham is the Dean of Australian Speechwriters, having worked for 6 Labor leaders: Calwell, Whitlam, Rann, Hawke, Unsworth and Carr. He also authored a number of books, including Churchill and Australia, and his wonderful memoir, A Figure of Speech. And joining us on the panel is Michael Cooney, the Executive Director of the Chifley Research Centre. Previously, he was speechwriter to Prime Minister Gillard, and he recently published this book, The Gillard Project, on his time as a speechwriter in government. We'll have about half an hour in conversation with the three of us, and then we'll be delighted to take some questions. So let me start, Graham, with you, the principal author of that speech. Tell us what your memories are of that speech, if you would. What was it like? What was the atmosphere like? What was the writing of it like?
I must first of all say, I must thank, if that's the word, Alan Ramsay for immortalising that speech, or at least my role in it, because Alan was in the gallery at the time for The Australian. And you must remember, the role of speechwriter was a complete secret in those days. In fact, there was a general...
Love that dare not speak its name.
Yes. Well, there was a gentleman's agreement, and they were all gentlemen in the press gallery in those days, that staff, and certainly such a creature as a speechwriter, just didn't exist. And it was only Alan, about 20 years after the event, Alan Ramsey, by now with his column in the Sydney Morning Herald, revived the speech and, of course, paid tribute to my role in it. But that's one of the things that shows the great difference between then and now, certainly in terms of the pressures on political leaders. And the other point I make, not about the content or the substance, but the Menzies made his announcement on the Thursday, in the Parliament, on the Thursday, the 29th of April, 1969, the announcement that the first battalion would go to Vietnam, and made in extraordinary circumstances, the real significance of which was not really realised until many years later. The significance being that the invitation for our troops to go to Vietnam had to be procured from the Prime Minister of Saigon. But leaving that aside, we had 5 days really to prepare that speech without Colwall, the leader of the opposition, the leader of the Federal Parliamentary Labour Party, once being harassed or even asked or invited to make his comment. The response to a parliamentary statement by the Prime Minister would be made in the Parliament, and that was it. Inconceivable today, in the day, and it just shows the difference in the pressures that that leaders are unto, and it's the exact contrast. And if I might quote, because I think it provides a theme, drawing on that experience, but a theme for much of what we might say today, and it's from Henry Kissinger in his new book, World Order, and Kissinger says, new methods of accessing and communicating information unite regions as never before and project events globally, but in a manner that inhibits reflection, demanding of leaders that they register instantaneous reactions in a form expressible in slogans. And that describes the world in which the leaders make speeches today, and it's a great contrast to the more leisurely and less pressurised days in which I was able to take 5 days to work out a presentation for the Labour Party's stance on Vietnam.
Let me bring Michael Cooney in. Michael, that would have been situation normal for you in Gillard's office, wouldn't it? If you had a big speech, five unlimited days, nothing to do, no journalists knocking on the door, take your time, come up with the pearls of wisdom.
That's almost exactly how it worked, yes. we gave a speech in this room, or the Prime Minister, I should say, gave a speech in this room to launch the Asian Century White Paper in, I think, September 2012. And we'd sat down 3 weeks out and said, right, this time we're not going to have any last-minute panics, right? Really, like we're going to get it right this time. This is actually our white paper. We're not caught by surprise by this event. it's our diary. We're going to get it right. So that was a mistake. I'll never say that again. In the 5 days before that speech, the PM was in Sydney on the Tuesday and spent an hour and a half driving to cow pastures, where she opened a philanthropically founded centre at the University of Western Sydney, and then drove back. The next day, she then drove over almost exactly the same road. So that was on a Wednesday, and spent a really tough afternoon, actually an important afternoon, but a really tough afternoon visiting at the ADF hospital at Holsworthy, visiting wounded soldiers returned from Afghanistan. So that was Wednesday. Thursday, the Prime Minister flew to her seat, on some counts the safest seat in Australia, and did 13 public appearances in 13 suits, so there'd be material for photos for local events for the rest of the year. So there was sort of continuity direction going on. And then on Friday we flew to Adelaide, or I say we didn't really fly to Adelaide, we flew to the RAF base north of Adelaide, and the PM then drove to the mouth of the Murray and did an announcement there about the Murray, while we drove seemingly nearly as far into Adelaide along the world's straightest road, right in the speech in the back of the van, of course. Got to Adelaide, where the PM then the next day gave a speech to the South Australian ALP convention, flew back to Sydney Saturday afternoon, speech is Sunday morning, and on Sunday morning, we were here at, I suppose, 11:30, at 10 o'clock, the Prime Minister had a charity reception in her house for the McGrath Foundation. And we finished the speech during the charity reception. The PM was sort of popping out of the cupcakes, popping in, bringing cupcakes for the speechwriter, which was good of her, have a quick chat about some final policy details, and then she popped back into the reception to say thanks to the breast cancer nurses, and then we jumped in the car and came across the bridge. So we did have 5 days. I'm not sure we used them quite as well as Graham.
But those are self-inflicted wounds, to be fair. What about the question that now, if a major policy announcement came out, there just wouldn't be the time, or would there be the time, for you to craft a policy response and then words around it that might have some chance of lasting? Or is that pressure impossible to resist?
Well, famously during Simon Crean's address to the National Press Club on domestic policy in 2003, I think it must have been. No, that can't be right. Anyway, yeah, maybe it was 2003. Combat operations commenced in Iraq during his speech. And so the first question at the end of his speech, live on camera, was, well, do you want us to win the war? Which he didn't have a great answer to, unsurprisingly. It wasn't an easy question to answer, and that was 15 minutes after the bombing had started.
Well, that, of course, was the same question that was haunted Colwell and Whitlam during Vietnam. You want Ho Chi Minh to win the war. In the end, Whitlam said, America can't win and shouldn't win. So, in fact, our final answer was yes. We think he should win the war.
The complaint, I mean, we hear a lot of complaints now about social media downplaying or undermining the role of speeches. But, in fact, prime ministers have been complaining about the declining space for speeches for a long time. Let me quote Paul Keating in the 1990s. He had a wonderful line on the treatment of speeches in modern politics. He said, if Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address now, the chances are the journalists wouldn't report the speech, but the doorstop that followed it. And the first question they'd ask is, how come you're talking about democracy and freedom when there's a war going on? And there'd be learned articles at the weekend about whether it had been a lapse of political judgment for Mr. Lincoln to deliver the Gettysburg Address in Gettysburg instead of Philadelphia. So, Graham, what do you think? I mean, is there still a role for speeches?
The social, as to the social media, I certainly know now what it must have been like to be illiterate in the 19th century. But this is a great new force, and I might say it is essentially a democratic force, and it must be seen as part of the continuing technological revolution that's been going on now and changing the face of civilization now for 500 or 400 years since the invention of the printing press. And perhaps another big change, and I think comparable to the social media revolution today, is the development of the mass circulation newspapers in the mid-19th century, which gave rise to a whole new form of parliamentary politics. It took speech-making outside. It took away the monopoly of Parliament, and, of course, people like Gladstone, Disraeli, used and Lincoln used these great forums of the public meeting to respond to and exploit the opportunities of the mass circulation newspapers. And I think a comparable revolution is going on today. We haven't grasped its full potentialities, its full opportunities, but no less important, I think, than the revolutions that the communication revolutions that have been going on for 500 years. I must say, but they all bring new pressures on the leader, on the political leaders in a democracy.
Well, one way that social media, it seems to me, liberates speeches in a way is that it liberates them from the archives. It means that we can access them, anybody can access them. And you think of Obama's speech in 2004 to the Boston Democratic National Convention. I was very lucky enough to be in the room for that. That was a speech that lived on because people could see it on YouTube, not just read it in the papers. I mean, they could see it. It got millions of hits. So, Michael, when you think about the social media changes, do you think the net effect is negative or positive for speeches?
I think there's two things going on. There's a kind of an immediate transaction, sort of a first order effect, where yes, everything's reduced to a shorter number of words, and that's what you read. But I do think that the capacity to, in a sense, self-publish and to share is fundamentally good for speeches. That's really what speeches are. And specifically, people now, as you say, can actually listen to and see a speech rather than read it. So, for instance, the president's recent speech at the memorial service.
Amazing Grace.
States, yeah. Spread everywhere. And most people saw that speech before they read about it, I think. So the capacity to share a link and to actually show what you've really said, I think is quite powerful, and it returns speeches potentially to the audience of people who hear them. And really that is as well as their extended form, the speech is two things. Yes, it's an essay, but it's also written to be heard, and that gives it its particular written character at a micro level. And I think people now hear more speeches, and that's or are about to hear more speeches in a fundamentally good way.
Absolutely, and I think, Michael, you touch on a point that's not perhaps fully realised. And it's the point of continuity. Our society today, this society, has a far greater sense of continuity than any previous generation. I mean, this occasion where the peg we're hanging on is a speech made 50 years ago. And we do, because of the new technologies, starting off, of course, overwhelming with television, which only became a political medium around the 60s, 70s. But among the general public, there is a much greater sense of familiarity with incidents of the past than at any time in our human history, and this is something very valuable. Of course, because of there is such a lot of noise now that it's very difficult for the good message to get across, but nonetheless, the opportunities and potentials are very great. And as I repeat, the trend is essentially democratic.
Let me ask you a couple of questions on foreign policy speeches in particular, and then I'll give the audience an opportunity to ask questions. And maybe I'll start with you, Michael, and then get Graham to chip in. Let me make a provocative speech, a provocation. I think that that foreign policy is the area of underperformance for Australian political speeches. I think when I was editing a collection of great Australian speeches, I assumed in when I began my researches that I'd find many arresting, striking foreign policy speeches, but I didn't really. I found that the speeches given on domestic political topics and given in our country, they were the ones that really sang. They were the ones that all of us who are speech geeks remember. But it was much harder to find terrific foreign policy speeches. You do find some, and they tend to be around moments of combat. We were talking about Curtin's speech at the Battle of the Coral Sea. There are some speeches by soldiers on the battlefield. Percy Spender's first speech as External Affairs Minister. There are some, but in general, I found them workmanlike. They performed the function of relaying the information and establishing the policy, but they didn't really live later. So I'd ask you maybe, Michael, to start to reflect on that. Am I right? If I am right, if they're less interesting perhaps than they should be, is that because foreign policy is so technical, you've got to be careful about it? Is it because officials are involved and the dead weight of the bureaucracy on the speechwriter's writing hand? Or is it that Australia's size and the role we play in the world has conditioned our foreign policy in the direction of pragmatism, and that doesn't make for ringing rhetoric in the same way that US foreign policy enables memorable speeches by US presidents?
I think you probably are right overall. I think that Australian speeches on foreign policy have a somewhat different function from our domestic policy speeches, because often the foreign policy speech actually is the policy, that the typical domestic policy speech announces a thing, the budget or a white paper or a policy release or a change or a reform. Whereas it's often true that the foreign policy speech literally contains the actual policy. It is the statement of the government's policy. And I think that creates a set of pressures that otherwise don't exist and a set of freedoms permitted to the domestic speech. I do think that the kind of a game theoretical analysis of the relationship between the speechwriter and the rest of the people advising the Prime Minister is a helpful way of thinking about the problems of foreign policy speeches. I think that, certainly in my experience, that the speechwriters and the private office broadly actually felt less authority over these questions, less authority over the final outcome, more reliance on official advice, more reliance on a greater sense that there were terms of art that we were less familiar with. Although I confidently wrote speeches on the economy relying pretty solely on advisers in the PMO and a bit on advisers in the Treasurer's office, and didn't feel any particular need to I was confident to allow them to mediate any other official advice. The first time the Prime Minister gave a speech on Afghanistan, I literally had a pile the night before of 10 sets of official comments, multiples from different agencies, more than one from PM&C, more than one from DFAT, more than one from Defence. So there was a much greater sense that you sort of couldn't get it wrong. But I also think that really great occasions make great speeches, great forums, great places or moments. And it's our foreign policy role in the world hasn't typically put us in front of a wall demanding that it be torn down. When we do get a great moment, I think we sometimes grab it. But yeah, in the nature of our role and our self-conception, which might be even lower than our real role.
What about the issue, before I come to you, Graeme, what about the issue of the experience of the Prime Minister herself? In your case, she came to office without much of a foreign policy background. She said in that interview from Brussels that foreign policy wasn't her passion. Does that affect the point you're making about not feeling the same authority, at least in the early part in office, feeling much more comfortable talking about these other issues and therefore less willing to chance her arm, perhaps, on the foreign policy side?
Yeah, I think, in my experience of that period, the PM had just as much confidence on the core questions that she wanted to communicate in these speeches, but certainly on questions of, on the lots of kind of retail transactions within the drafting process of, can we use this expression which we prefer, or do we need to accept this piece of annoying advice from Defence Legal Authority about what it means, compared to this piece of annoying advice from the Productivity Commission about what it means. But we probably felt a bit more, you know, like we couldn't really stand up the DLO in the way that we could stand up the PC. So I think that's right. But I think that is a I think that effect was much more strongly felt. I mean, to give you a straightforward example, the Prime Minister's senior economic advisers were all people who had some official background, but were people who had spent a long period working in the government as advisers and typically were Labor Party connected people in some way or another. The Prime Minister's international advisor is an outstanding official, but someone who was an outstanding official who came into the role for that period and returned to the bureaucracy, now DGONA. So that I think that sort of transaction was essentially different.
Mm. Graham, what do you think? Am I right or wrong?
I don't agree with you. I always start off with the proposition that great speeches need great issues, or to put another, great issues produce great speeches, and great issues or great occasions. In Australia, the Vietnam is an unusual example of a big issue, huge issue, which was subject of great division, great national division. Conscription in the First War, and I think one can class that as a foreign affairs issue. The Second World War itself, but there were some great speeches, but not at the point of controversy. The Second Iraq War, and there was good debate on the Second Iraq War. A division, but not so deep or protracted as Vietnam. See, Vietnam did produce great speeches, the rally speeches, the parliamentary speeches. You mentioned, in fact, Menzies' reply to Colwell. That stands out as the most devastating foreign policy speech in my time. Menzies' reply to Colwell, to Colwell's fine speech. But Menzies, very political, but devastating. And that, to me, is the prime example of a debating speech that had devastating effect in its time. You mentioned the bureaucracy or the Foreign Affairs Department. Now, the Foreign Affairs Department is the guardian of Australian foreign policy and diplomacy, and the department seeks continuity, and the big changes in Australian foreign policy, obviously the recognition of China is one such, really came from opposition, Whitlam in opposition, and then by the time that we came into government in 1970, at the end of 1972, it was more or less the accepted policy, national policy, and has been built on by successive governments ever since. So since the Second World War, there have been great issues, Vietnam above all, but not great revolutions in policy that do, of their nature, provide the material for great and inspiring speech. But I must acknowledge the role of the positive role, the constructive role of the Department of Foreign Affairs in facilitating such changes as have been made by new governments coming in with some new policies or new approaches.
I'm actually going to take the step of quoting you back at yourself, Graham. Graham mentioned Menzies' response to Colwell's speech. It's interesting. We don't think of Menzies' response. And I asked when I published the first edition of this book, I asked Graham was very kind enough to write a foreword, and I asked him to address this issue of why we don't remember Menzies' response to Colwell. And you said as follows, Graham. You said that On that day, in that place, to that assembly, Menzies' reply was devastating. For 30 minutes, we were all under the wand of the magician. You said he made a parliamentary speech pure and simple. His purpose was to enthuse the members behind him and demoralise the members opposite. Hence his cynical conclusion, if I may end on a horribly political note, Mr. Speaker, it is occasionally a good thing to be in a majority. You said Mr. Corwell's speech, by contrast, was avowedly addressed to the Labor Party and its supporters outside. Indeed, given the undoubted unpopularity of opposition to the war in 1965, it was, in a very real sense, addressed to posterity. Unfortunately, posterity does not vote, but then it reads. It does read.
Yes. That is encouraging.
All right, let me take some questions. I've got some other questions that I want to put to Graham and Michael, but let me take some questions from the audience. I saw John Edwards at the back first. John Edwards
Thank
is a non-resident
John
fellow
Edwards,
here.
Affiliated with the Lowy Institute. And Graham, I wonder, I've often pondered, you know, this wonderful speech you wrote and the circumstances in which you would have written it, given Corwell's background. You know, I know you reverence his memory and you had great affection for him, but he was in many ways, you know, an intransigent, vituperative person. During the Curtin government, a real troublemaker. He was, you know, a lifelong, very deeply religious Catholic, very closely connected with Mannix. He was a sort of a, you know, he had kind of left-wing kind of characteristics, but old-time Labor left-wing characteristics. And yet that speech suddenly sort of projected him from, you know, this really forgotten past into a character that we remember now as almost leading, you know, the youth movement against Vietnam. It was the most extraordinary transition. And
yes.
What I really wonder is, had Corwell changed? But secondly, I can understand that Corwell was, you know, would have been motivated on conscription, a real old-time issue. But did you actually, could I ask you, do you think you actually moved him on the issue of Vietnam itself? In other words, it didn't really represent his point of view.
John's asking a very controversial question.
Wow.
He's asking the speechwriter to lift the veil on the mystery of speechwriting.
Yes. Well, I think the Menzies' announcement of the sending of combat troops in April 65, it didn't come completely out of the blue. We had advisors in South Vietnam from about 1962, I think. There was a long period of a gradual development of a Labor position in the event of a decision being made about combat troops. Now, I don't know if we're seeing a repeat of that in Iraq now, but the by April 65, there was really never any doubt that if Menzies announced that we would send combat troops, that the Labor Party would have to oppose it. This was the general sense within the party, and that the only way it would be possible to keep any semblance of unity on such an explosive issue within the Labor Party would be to oppose the commitment of combat troops. So the position really became one of presentation, or the problem really became one of presentation. How to present, and throughout the Vietnam, in the speech in particular, but throughout the Vietnam War, The Labor Party's dilemma was always how to square opposition to the war with the American alliance, how to denounce the war without denouncing the people who were perpetrating the war. And it was from if I might say so, any merit that the Colwell speech has lies not so much in its forecast of what would happen, like that America couldn't win and would be humiliated, couldn't win because it was a civil war. The analysis really flowed from the position of opposition to the of combat troops. The position was not reached by analysis. The analysis followed the position. So that's the great advantage of a party taking a position. You can use that as a creative use the political imperatives as a form of creativity to stimulate the intellect. But you're right, I mean, Colwell's engagement with the issue was not over so much sending troops, but sending conscripts. And once the conscripts were sent, they'd only reintroduced national service at the end of 1964, about 6 months before the announcement. Although the reason given for reintroducing national service was to meet our obligations vis-à-vis Malaysia and confrontation with Indonesia, not in the context of Vietnam.
Can I ask you, Graham, just to follow on from John's question, how much different was it writing foreign policy speeches for Whitlam, someone who was an agent of change in Australian foreign policy with a long history of travel and thinking on international matters?
Well, completely different, because Whitlam had a body by the time I came. And I always point out, you know, we call ourselves speechwriters, but these people don't get into the position of leadership without being very gifted speakers in their own right. I mean, it just follows on. I mean, I see my dear friend Stephen Mills, who wrote much more for Bob Hawke than I ever did, and much more important than I ever did, including the speeches leading to the creation of APEC. Stephen would scoff at the idea that we were Hawke speechwriters. Hawke made the speeches, and that was it. And but in Whitlam's case, from the time he came into Parliament, foreign affairs he made it one of his specialties, and of course, from 1953-54 on, he was calling for the recognition of the People's Republic of China, 19 years before he actually achieved it. So that by the time he became leader of the Labor Party, he had a very distinguished body of material to his credit. Now, the recent book by James Curran, Unholy Rage, The Relations Between Nixon and Whitlam, brings out very skillfully how the Whitlam speeches, the series of speeches between 67 and 72, mainly on Vietnam, Asia and China, and the American alliance, provided Whitlam with a whole body of an intellectual framework where he was well able to meet the onslaught of Nixon and Kissinger when Whitlam and the new Labor government outraged the White House by denouncing the Christmas bombing of Hanoi to force Hanoi back to the negotiating table. Curran brings out the importance of Whitlam having this body of an intellectual and thought through framework of policy developed over years consistently that was well able to withstand the Nixon's unholy rage.
You talk about social media and spreading these speeches en masse around the world, and obviously Julia's misogyny speech in that context, and she said at the time she knew it was a powerful speech because she could see the faces on the other side, but didn't think it would resonate like it did. And other speeches that and spring to mind, Obama's last couple of weeks in speech making. How much, I get back to the word influence, how much do you think that en masse spreading of the speeches now singing to the choir, preaching to the converted? I know in sharing on Instagram and Facebook and whatever, your friends are sending them around. I haven't got many friends on the other side of politics. So do you think that they have real influence in changing people's opinion, or is it merely, this is of course downplaying their importance of just the need to be something to be said and said beautifully, but just the difference between, I guess, influence and just spreading the word?
I do think that as you say, singing to the choir, that the power of social media in connecting people who agree with each other, it does actually can have more influence on politics than we might expect when you just describe it in those terms. I think that, in a sense, I think you can see on the progressive side of politics a sort of now, over the last couple of years, a kind of activation and connection of sort of argument and sentiment which is broadly pro the major party on the progressive side of politics, where people are sharing arguments and making themselves more articulate. And in a sense, Facebook and these other mechanisms are allowing people to do something which 2GB does for the other side. So, you know, there's a kind of, in any given lunchroom, there's kind of 10 people who don't think much about politics and there's one gobby type who does. And that person, if they're on the right, gets their lines from radio, and now they can get, if they're on the left, they can get their lines from Facebook. So I do think that's having one, that's one aspect of it. But it also is allowing the sharing of speeches, which I think at the moment are just the moments. So you don't, what you're not seeing when you're sharing a video of a speech at the moment is people aren't mostly watching the 20-minute, the argument unfold. They're watching the great dramatic moment in that speech. So it was a couple of really nice reviews written about Obama's eulogy, and it evidently is a very interestingly constructed speech with many clever elements, most of us have seen him start singing and everyone initially laugh and then realise he's fed income and go on with it. Actually, there's a lot said about grace in that speech in a very interesting and clever, sophisticated way that you still have to read. Yeah,
Graham, what do you think? I mean, Simon's really asking, do speeches still change people's minds, or when they're communicated via social media, is it more about creating a meeting of minds of people who already agree with each other?
I'm not sure how to answer that as to what should happen or what does happen. Simon's probably right about what does happen. Of course, I would say what should happen is that speeches should lead the debate or establish the groundwork for the debate. But ideally, particularly foreign affairs, speeches on foreign affairs, they should provide some sense of continuity, particularly if you're going to change a standing policy. For instance, supposing, as it may become necessary for us to modify the staunchness of the American alliance. See, Malcolm Fraser goes so far as to suggest we might have to end the alliance. Now, I certainly wouldn't say that, but I think it is clear that...
He didn't say that in his earlier speeches as Minister of Defence and Prime Minister, did he?
No. Well, with Malcolm, it is a question of which Malcolm you're talking about. They have to provide an argument. I think, argument in a speech is a bit of a hobby horse of mine, because I think that a speech really is as good as its argument. Mm. I deplore the tendency for speeches to be a succession of cliches or buzzwords or even 30-second grabs or slogans. But again, you know, getting back to Kissinger, instantaneous reactions in a form expressible in slogans. I mean, I think the politicians and the political leaders have to resist the pressure to speak just in slogans or speak just in... They have to lead, and you can't lead except by argument.
We should fight them in the bookshops.
Well, Michael, there's a couple of things you can do. So I think that the Keating thing about Gettysburg is funny. Although, actually, the papers did sort of slaughter the Gettysburg Address, actually. But one choice you have is not to give a doorstop after the Gettysburg Address. And we do have to think about how, if you're going to try to persuade people through these longer forms, you've got to actually restrict yourself to that longer form sometimes in order to let it get up. If you give a doorstop after a set-piece speech, well, unsurprisingly, they'll use it.
Lincoln would have told one of his funny stories,
yes.
And that would have been the end of the Gettysburg Address.
I think the continuity point is interesting because often the persuasion is directed towards the mediators, and I think speeches do have a particular role in their long form in persuading the describers, the explainers, the analysers, the, not just reporters but commentators. And one particular example of that is the capacity of a speech to create an elaborate framework for explaining why a change is actually not a change, why there's a, you know, and that's often necessary not only in foreign policies. I think often of the epistles of Paul, which are very clever at explaining why we're going to chuck out something from the old law, and in fact we're completing the old law by doing this, right? Now, you might think the reason why a missionary religion abandons the practice of circumcision is a more pragmatic one, but no, Paul's got a philosophical explanation for why it's necessary that we're no longer circumcised, you know, adult male converts. He's probably right in philosophy as well.
Mm.
But that's a function which really only the long form argument can have, is to persuade the mediators and the explainers that you've got an argument and that it stands up.
I wouldn't have guessed that we would get onto circumcision in this event. I'm going to take the last question from Sarah Davidson, please.
Hello, Sarah Davidson with Chartered Accountants Australia and New Zealand, and recently an employee of Law Institute, so happy to be back. Question for you, I'm particularly interested in the role of the speechwriter, how you see that evolving in light of the discussion today, and also how speeches are used to lead and influence others. So I guess we see over time now that leaders are not so much the people standing out in front speaking, leading from the front, but people who are able to build consensus and encourage habits of leadership and cooperation. I guess a good example of that in a foreign policy context might be your G20 forums and that need to build consensus cooperation. So I was just wondering, from your experience, have you seen or have you experienced an evolution in the role of the speechwriter from scripted speeches, for example, to helping a leader to facilitate discussion, dialogue, debate, build consensus?
Forums are very bad for speechwriters. Forums are all about multilateralism. Yeah, it's all about interventions rather than about heroic bilateral visits with marvellous speeches given in congresses. So it is an interesting point you make more broadly about cooperative and collaborative styles of leadership that rely less on this kind of heroic figure at a podium making this case as if they're on the prow of a ship to someone who, you know, is leading from among the group. In some ways, that might be a more traditional Westminster first among equals role for a Prime Minister. But clearly we still, on the one hand, we confront a lot of substantive problems which require that style of leadership. But on the other hand, political, media and broader social culture that puts a huge weight on a very, you know, traditional heroic masculine self-figure of the Prime Minister as footy coach, the Prime Minister as kind of, as this kind of leading figure haranguing, waving their hand around. I think that, and that is an interesting challenge to the role of speeches and speech writing, is that greater collaboration. I mean, my observation of the role of the speechwriter, they play an interesting role in the office, and among the advisors, you've sort of got a mix of you're kind of half rodeo clown, half Shakespearean fool. You're the one who gets to go in with something nice. Everyone else brings a problem to the Prime Minister. And so one of the good things about being the speechwriter is you get to come in and say, oh, I've been reading this interesting thing and I thought we could make you look clever by dropping this anecdote in a speech. So if you get a chance to do the job, I highly recommend it because it's much less stressful than the sort of people who make real decisions like Simon did. The transactions are more beneficent.
Yeah. And these days also speechwriters can get a book out of their
service.
Well,
people ask me why I wrote the book, and I mean, like, there are many rationalisations, but this is why you write the book. I mean, this is it wasn't for history, it was for this panel, right?
Well, let me finish and let me give the final word to you, Graham, on exactly this question about the changing role of speechwriters. I think you were saying upstairs to us that speechwriters have come out of the closet, in a way. Back in the day, speechwriters were invisible. Now they're sort of edging onto the stage.
Yes.
Is this a good thing?
It's a trend much more noticeable in the United States. And, in fact, the people discussing the role of speechwriters with, say, Reagan or George W. Bush, write in terms of the speechwriters in the White House, the speechwriters took this position, the speechwriters took that position. Now, in the Hawke or Whitlam governments, that would have been inconceivable, although the speechwriters might have thrashed out between them what they would. But the idea of the speechwriters being a block within the office would be inconceivable. But I think, I said that speechwriters had become public, and Alan Ramsey was one of the first to do, but that really goes for staff generally. The staff were invisible, didn't just non-existence, and that was the sort of the unwritten code. Now it's just things are changing, and it's no good repining about it. It's going to happen. But the essentials remain the same. The strong leader will provide strong leadership in his staff, as in his cabinet or in his party or in his country. It's like the social media. You've got to. It's not just a matter of grudgingly acknowledging their existence. It's the matter of understanding it better, adjusting to it, adapting to it, and ultimately, as politicians will always find ways to exploit the situation with which they're presented. I always give the instance that after the translation of the Bible into English and the Shakespearean contribution to the language, there was a huge explosion of pamphleteering and what they used to call libels in London and in England generally in the early 1600s, in the period leading up to the Civil War. And the Long Parliament introduced an act to suppress these libels. They were just ordinary people writing what they thought and using this new language that Shakespeare had partly given them and the Bible in English had given them, using this wonderful new language to express themselves. And the Long Parliament tried to suppress these things, just as people are trying to suppress things today. But the upshot of these libels and the thing was Milton's great essay, the Areopagitica, which is the great defence of freedom of the press, unequalled in English or any other language. So out of this chaos and this anarchy that these inconvenient inventions and technologies produce, there comes a new order and a new way of dealing with you.
As usual, Graham ends the speech on a beautiful note. Thank you, Graham. I want to finish with one anecdote on Sarah's question about the changing role of speechwriters. The orthodox position, I once saw the orthodox position on this expressed by Ted Sorensen, who was JFK's speechwriter. Kennedy himself referred to him as my intellectual blood bank. And I was a university student. I was staying with a friend of mine at Harvard, and I saw an ad for a masterclass on speechwriting by Ted Sorensen. So I scurried along to it, and Sorensen looked fantastic. He was in his 80s. He gave this speech. And then the first question was, who wrote Kennedy's inaugural address with the great line, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Did Kennedy write that speech or did you write it, Mr. Sorensen? And Sorensen said, you know, every time I give a speech, I'm asked that question. I'm always asked, who wrote that line, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And I always reply in the same way, ask not. Ladies and gentlemen, I think it's been a real treat today to hear from two prime ministerial speechwriters, from Michael Cooney, who worked for Julia Gillard, and in particular for someone who's played really a very significant role in Australian history over half a century, Graham Freudenberg. Please join me in thanking Michael and Graham. Graham reminds me that I promised he could quote his favourite speech. Graham, do you want to finish?
I'm going to quote it in full.
He's going to quote it in full, but it's not long.
My favourite foreign policy speech, and I'll quote it in full. And it's from Pitt the Younger in 1805, just after the Battle of Trafalgar. And he's at the Lord Mayor's banquet at the Guildhall in London, not long before he died on hearing the disastrous news of the Battle of Napoleon's victory at Austerlitz. But the toast is given to William, Prime Minister Pitt, the saviour of England. This is just after Trafalgar, you see. And his reply to the toast, the saviour of England, was, I return many thanks for the honour you have done me. But Europe is not to be saved by any single man. England has saved herself by her exertions and will, I trust, save Europe by her example. End of speech.
Brilliant.
I don't think there doesn't appear any William Pitt on the horizons in Europe at the moment.
All right, thank you, ladies and gentlemen.